Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week, I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, so I'm not going to spend too much time on the opening. I just want to say thank you for all the feedback and the kind words regarding my episode with Dr. Priya. You guys all seem to love her. We're going to have her back for sure. As I said on the episode, we have the new show coming out in 2026. And if any other cases come up where I need a pathologist to come in and speak about a particular autopsy that we're discussing, she's available. She's awesome. She would gladly come back. And she was reading some of the comments and stuff, and she also wanted to pass along her thanks for all the kind words. As far as the case, this will be our third and final part of our coverage on Ellen Greenberg. I've tried to cover a lot. We're going to cover a lot more tonight, and then I'm going to give my perspective at the end. But overall, you know, this was an interesting case because technically it's not unsolved, right? We have two different opinions that have come back and essentially affirmed the first opinion regarding it being a suicide. But there was just such an outcry for this one. And in fact, I've had so many people come up to me, family members and friends who know that I do a podcast and have never mentioned any of the cases I've covered before. And I recently saw a few of them and they were like, hey, I see you're covering the Ellen Greenberg case. It's so interesting. And I'm like, I didn't even know you watched my podcast. And then in the office and at home, I've talked to all the members of my team here, from Haley to Shannon to Ashley and even Stephanie. I was talking about it with her before recording Crime Weekly. Everyone is enamored by this case. And most people agree that just something doesn't smell right. And that's ultimately why I decided to cover it. This isn't just a one-off. We may do this again. I would love to hear your thoughts and opinions on it, because if it's something that you guys prefer, I will do it more often. I'm not going to ever cut out the unsolved cases, and that's always going to be the main bread and butter of what we do here. But if this is something that you think is necessary and you get value out of, I'll definitely do it again. But with that out of the way, let's dive into part three of Ellen's case, starting with a quick recap from part one, because we had the interview last week. I didn't really go over the specifics of the case again, so I want to give everyone a refresher. On January 26, 2011, Ellen Greenberg left work early during a snowstorm in Philadelphia and went home to her apartment she shared with her fiancé, Sam Goldberg. Hours later, at 6:33 p.m., Sam called 911 and said he found Ellen in the kitchen with a knife in her chest. She had been stabbed nearly two dozen times, including multiple wounds to the back of her head and neck. Despite the severity of her injuries, detectives immediately theorized Ellen's death was a suicide, and the scene was not processed as a homicide. During the autopsy the next day, Dr. Marlon Osborne found several deep neck wounds that could have incapacitated Ellen, and he ruled her death a homicide. Police pushed back, and the ruling was later changed to suicide. Believing their daughter did not take her own life, the Greenbergs launched their own investigation. They requested copies of her autopsy report and photos, Dr. Osborne's report from the scene, and the handful of photos that were taken by detectives while they were still on scene. They sent that evidence to multiple experts, and every single one of them concluded that Ellen's death was a homicide. Now, I'm not going to break down the medical findings here because I already spoke in depth with Dr. Priya Banerjee about it in part two, but I do want to talk about what the other types of experts found, starting with the latch on the front door. Now, one of the main reasons that Dr. Osborne believed Ellen's death could be a suicide was the assumption that the latch on the front door was locked from the inside. But Tom Brennan, a chief of detectives in a different county who reviewed Ellen's case, found online videos demonstrating how easy it is to lock a swing bar latch from the outside. It doesn't require any special tools, and it can be done in seconds. Melissa Ware, the property manager at Ellen's apartment, said the same thing. She explained that the latch could be locked from the outside and that she had even done it herself by accident when closing the door too firmly. Then there's Detective Scott Ellman, a specialist in crime scene reconstruction, evidence processing, and management. He also agreed that the door could be latched from the outside. He also pointed out that while there was damage to the door around the latch, it remained attached to the door with the screws still in place. He also noted that the floor below the latch didn't show any signs of visible debris, and I also noticed that and thought that was interesting because normally in a breaking and entering situation, especially if there's forced entry, usually you'll see little pieces of paint or wood on the floor unless someone's cleaned it up, and normally the robbers don't clean up after themselves. So you would expect to see that, and you would think in this scenario, if Sam had broken the latch off the door and went inside and found Ellen, he too wouldn't have had time to clean up after himself. So all of these expert observations suggested that Sam didn't break the door down the way he had claimed. And it is an issue for me as well. But my issue with the latch goes even deeper, and we can talk about it right here because this is going to be a long episode, and if I save it to the end during the perspective, I'm going to forget it. There's no doubt about it. I have it all written down, but my handwriting's chicken scratch, and there is a likelihood that I'm going to forget to mention it, and then I'll be mad for the next 3 months every time I review this episode. So we're not going to do that. To me, the latch, it's clearly broken. The question to me that's most important is how and when, right? First, if it can be broken from the inside, that's important, meaning if he latched the door while he was in the apartment after whatever happened to Ellen, and he can pull on the doorknob and cause the same type of damage, well, that diminishes the importance of the latch because now that damage could have been caused either way. Another issue that I have is we don't know what type of damage was on the door before this incident. Was there ever a scenario in the apartment where accidentally or intentionally Sam or Ellen pushed on the door and almost broke the latch off? Maybe that would explain why there was no debris on the ground, meaning, yes, there was damage to the latch, but it was from a prior incident. And then my final concern is the when, right? When was the latch broken if it was broken on that day? I do think we have to acknowledge that there is a scenario where when Sam comes upstairs the first time, he is frustrated and he immediately breaks the latch off the door. And once he goes inside, Ellen, who potentially is still alive at that point, gets into an argument with him. And then whatever happens after that is what happens. And that's when she's killed. And so, yes, the latch could have been broken by Sam, and it could be around the same time when this whole thing occurred. But the difference between 20 and 30 minutes of that latch breaking could be the difference between a suicide and a homicide. If you follow what I'm saying here, everything he's saying could be true as far as breaking the latch, but he could be lying about the fact of when he broke it, and that could be all the difference in this case. And as far as the experts, Ellman and Brennan also had concerns about the blood at the scene. Ellman focused on the blood stain located between Ellen's right hand and her glasses. He pointed to a sharp outline of the stain, which he said indicated something interrupted the normal spread of the blood or that the stain had been altered after it formed. He also observed a pinkish area along the lower portion of the stain that could point to wiping, partial cleanup, or another form of disturbance. Within the stain, he detected a pattern that may have come from a shoe tread or a similar object making contact. And then Brennan came in and he raised an additional issue regarding a thin trail of blood that was visible on Ellen's left cheek, stretching sideways near her nose toward her ear. He emphasized that this direction of flow didn't fit the final resting position of her body, which, if anyone has seen those photos, was seated with her back leaning up against the kitchen cabinets. And I do want to address that real quick. We haven't shown those crime scene photos which are out there, mostly because I don't want to put them out there if the family members are going to be watching this. And I'm not going to say the name, but I do know at least one family member has watched the videos and has commented on it and had positive things to say. They reached out, but I don't know who else is watching it. More importantly, I don't want this video to be restricted where it's not reaching as many people as possible because YouTube flags it. So there's multiple reasons why I'm not including those crime scene photos. There's no way to blur them out where they would still be readable, but also suitable for YouTube. And I think you can go out there and look for yourself if you have the stomach to do so. And in fact, if you do, I suggest that maybe you explore some of those images because it really does add a lot of context. I had a vision of what the apartment looked like before I looked up the photos, and that was completely altered after viewing the photos. And I will say that happens quite often. We always have this vision in our head, and then when we see the actual crime scene, it's completely different. Back to Brendan's analysis, because I do think it's interesting. If Ellen had inflicted the wounds while she was upright and then collapsed into this slumped position without moving again, the blood, you would expect it to run down her cheek, not towards the side of her face. And to Brennan, that horizontal line suggested that her body had been moved after she was injured. So that is extremely interesting. And I agree, unless she was moved immediately after by Sam, it's a high likelihood that that blood would have had some staining, even just a little bit, in the original direction it was going before Sam moved her. So for example, if she had been laying there for 5-10 minutes and this blood was trickling from her nose down her face, you would see it going in the direction that gravity would take it. So even if he came in and laid her down flat because he was going to administer CPR or whatever, you would still expect to see the original blood trail, at least a little bit of it. So now you would have the original blood trail, and then maybe you would have some blood coming off of it. Or if it was still coming out of her nose, you would have two blood trails. But that's not the case. According to court documents, the Greenbergs' attorney also pointed to inconsistencies involving the knife block the knife came from. He found it notable that the block was tipped over on its side and had been knocked over with enough force to send two knives across the counter and into the sink. He said that kind of disturbance suggested a situation where someone grabbed a knife quickly and forcefully during a confrontation rather than a person alone preparing a fruit salad. And just to take that a step further, if it was someone getting ready to commit suicide, they would know what they're about to do. There would be no reason to grab the knife and throw the knife block. You'd grab the knife you were looking for, the one that you thought would get the job done, and that would be it. So although he's not an expert in this area, as I'm not either, I do concur with his opinion of what the knife block represents. It doesn't look like someone who is getting ready to prep some food or to end their own life. The Greenbergs noted a few other concerns. Photographs from the scene show that Ellen's makeup bags were out on the bathroom counter next to her scarf. This stood out because she didn't typically keep those bags out. The Greenbergs also thought it was notable that Ellen was found wearing her boots when she normally just wore socks indoors. All of this, the wearing of the boots, the makeup bags being out, to Josh and Sandy, this signaled that potentially Ellen was preparing to leave. And that possibility became more significant when considering concerns about Ellen and Sam's relationship. According to Ellen's best friend Allison, who spoke to CNN in late 2024, Ellen's relationship with Sam was changing, and it was also changing her. Ellen seemed increasingly reliant on Sam's opinion. For example, when making plans, Allison noticed that Ellen felt she needed to ask Sam what he thought. That was not the confident, independent Ellen she once knew. Her cousin Debbie shared something similar and added that Ellen had started coming over and sleeping in her guest room. And then shortly before her death, she mentioned the possibility of moving in with Debbie. And when Debbie asked if Sam would be coming with her, Ellen didn't answer. So this right here, this is concerning. This is something that needs to be explored. Because I know some people point to the fact that before her death, Ellen never disclosed to anybody close to her, her family members, her friends, her colleagues, her psychiatrist, that there was anything wrong with her relationship and Sam. And we have to address the elephant in the room. And some of you guys have addressed it in the comments as well. Just because someone doesn't say verbally that there's a problem at home, it doesn't mean that there's not. There are many cases out there that can prove that a lot of victims are too in fear to speak out against their abuser or are embarrassed by what they're going through. They thought that person was going to be their forever person and they're getting ready to get married and they may not want to share this information with people in their lives because if things get better, now their family and friends may look at their loved one differently. So there could be a plethora of reasons why, if something was going on between Ellen and Sam, Ellen may have made the choice not to share that information. So the fact that you have these other details coming out now where it's physical things that may indicate Ellen didn't feel comfortable at home, I think that's important, especially when you consider what we're here talking about. Based on everything they had gathered so far, the Greenbergs knew they were on the right track, and they attempted to get the case reopened, but those efforts weren't successful. So they kept pushing, asking anyone who would listen to take another look. In 2015, Guy DeAndre, a prosecutor with the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, was asked to review Ellen's case. He said yes, and ultimately reached many of the same conclusions the other experts had already made. He also uncovered something extremely alarming. The neuropathology report on Ellen's spinal cord, you know, the report used to justify changing her manner of death from a suicide to a homicide, yeah, that report, it was missing. So if you remember from part one, Dr. Osborne had said that Ellen couldn't have continued stabbing herself after injuring her spinal cord. So he asked a neuropathologist, and this was Dr. Lucy Rourke Adams, to review the section of spinal cord that he had removed. According to Dr. Osborne and authorities, Dr. Rourke Adams examined Ellen's spinal cord and concluded that she would have been able to continue stabbing herself. This is what led Dr. Osborne to change that manner of death to a suicide. But here's the thing. When DeAndre searched the case files, he couldn't find Dr. Rourke Adams' actual report. There was only a note referencing what she had supposedly found during her examination. So he contacted detectives and the medical examiner's office to try and obtain a copy, but he was told that they couldn't find it or it didn't exist. They also said there was no invoice for the actual service, so basically, no evidence that this examination was actually conducted. But DeAndre took it a step further. He reached out to Dr. Rourke Adams directly via email, and she said she had no reports for Ellen's case. She said there was a, quote, remote possibility it was shown to her, but she had no recollection of the case. All of this led her to believe she had never seen Ellen's spinal cord. Let me say that again. The doctor, who allegedly provided an opinion that swayed the original doctor, Dr. Osborne, to change his determination of Ellen's autopsy, is now saying, I don't think I ever even saw Ellen's spinal cord. I wish I was making this up, but these are the facts. And as you might expect, because I'm sure you're as confused as I am at this point, DeAndre finds out this information after speaking to Dr. Rourke Adams, and he raises these concerns with the district attorney's office, but shocker, nothing came of it. Now, I do want to mention that the case was later sent to the attorney general's office for review, but they agreed with the suicide ruling and declined to investigate further. And I've had some personal experiences with that attorney general's office, and I can tell you, if you watched my Breaking Homicide episode on Cody Joyce, they were not pleasant. In fact, I basically got kicked out of their building. So I don't have a lot of kind things to say about them, and I don't have a lot of trust in them. But that's just my experience. So take of that what you will. We have a lot more to cover. I'm just getting into it. I still want to go over the whole timeline again because I think that's significant, but we're going to get into it right after the break. You know, promoting cat food when I don't have a cat, you may think that would be hard, but so many people speak so highly about Smalls cat food, including my sister, who I trust because she treats her cats like her kids, that I'm excited to share Smalls with you guys. And I never realized that the cat food my friends and family buy have so many bad ingredients, and you need to know that there are better options out there. So you gotta ask yourself a few questions. Does your cat have gut issues? Do you want them to have a healthier, shinier coat? Do you want less stinky litter boxes? Or maybe you just want a diet upgrade for your cat. If you answered yes to any of those questions, maybe it's time to upgrade to Smalls. Speaking of which, this podcast is sponsored by Smalls. For a limited time, you can get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head over to smalls.com/detective. Smalls cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients you'd find right in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. That's why cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. And starting with Smalls is easy. Just share info about your cat's diet, health, and food preferences, then Smalls will put together a personalized sampler for your cat, so no picking between random brands at the store. Smalls has the right food to satisfy any cat's cravings. Smalls was started back in 2017 by a couple of guys home cooking cat food in small batches for their friends. A few short years later, they've served millions of meals to cats across the US, and what I really love is that they work with the Humane World for Animals donating over $1 million worth of food to help cats. They also give you a chance to donate at checkout, so you can donate $5 for flea and tick medications or $7 for vaccines. And now you can add other cat favorites like amazing treats and snacks to your Smalls order, so it just keeps getting better and better. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements, and that's a big deal. The team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. That means they'll refund you if your cat won't eat their food. Pretty simple. So what are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve for a limited time, because your Detective Perspective listener or viewer gets 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head over to smalls.com/detective. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head over to smalls.com/detective. All right, we're back, and in 2019, Ellen's case really started to heat up when investigative journalist Stephanie Farr published an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer that revealed many of the issues in the case that experts had identified. While reporting, Farr reached out to the Attorney General's office for an update. That office stated Ellen's death was reviewed and confirmed as a suicide. They also claimed that Ellen's personal laptop showed web searches for phrases like, quote, methods of committing suicide, painless suicide, quick death, and desperation between December 18th and January 10th. This came as a surprise to everyone, because back in 2011, the FBI searched her computer and found nothing. The autopsy report even stated that there was, quote, nothing indicative of a suicide on the computers or in the rest of the apartment. So this really was a surprise to everyone. And this new search term report was never provided to Ellen's parents or their attorneys. DeAndra never saw it either, and he worked for the district attorney's office. When Farr asked the attorney general's office why that information wasn't in the original investigative files, they responded that they had obtained the analysis from the FBI in 2018, so it hadn't been in the files anyone else reviewed. The Greenbergs and their attorney believe that if this report actually exists, it's a red herring. There is no way to confirm who made the searches, and if Ellen truly did make the search, why did she search for, quote, painless suicide, but then decide to stab herself 20 times? Farr also asked the Attorney General's office about Dr. Rourke Adams and the supposed spinal cord examination. She mentioned that Dr. Rourke Adams confirmed to her that she had no recollection of working on the case, and that the lack of any invoice or written report confirmed she had no involvement. The AG's office told Farr that there was, quote, ample evidence in the case, and Dr. Rourke Adams did review the spinal cord, but no evidence proving that was the case was provided to Farr or anybody else for that matter. Following the release of Stephanie Farr's article, the Greenbergs continued fighting for answers. They brought in clinical neuropsychologist Dr. Louis Lazarus to review Ellen's injuries using a 3D computer model based on her autopsy findings. Dr. Lazarus's program generated 3D recreations of Ellen's wounds and then simulated whether she could have inflicted them herself. According to his findings, it was impossible for Ellen to deliver 11 of the 20 stab wounds on her own. He also noted that none of the stab wounds showed any signs of hesitation. Everything Dr. Lazarus found pointed to a homicide, just like all the other experts we've talked about tonight. So, using everything they had uncovered so far, Ellen's parents filed a civil lawsuit against Dr. Osborne and the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office. Their goal was simple: force a reevaluation of Ellen's manner of death. They wanted the ruling changed from a suicide to a homicide so that a full investigation could take place. The lawsuit moved forward, which gave the Greenbergs the ability to conduct a deeper review of Ellen's case. And during that process, they learned a lot of new information. Let's start with a timeline from January 26, 2011, the day that Ellen died. Now, some of these things we've already talked about in this series, but I want to bring them up again so that we can all get a full picture. At 3:47 p.m., Ellen stopped using her phone. Now, what's interesting here is that CNN reported that Sam's phone also went quiet around the same time and remained that way for nearly 2 hours. Now, according to Sam, he left the apartment at 4:45 p.m. to go to the gym, and I do want to mention here that at 4:46 p.m., Ellen's work laptop showed activity for the last time. So, could be a coincidence, could be something. It's at least worth noting. Sam gets to the gym at 4:51 p.m. And we're able to confirm some of this through the surveillance footage at the apartment complex. And speaking of surveillance footage, there's a lot out there. You have the lobby. You also have the entryway to the parking lot for the apartment complex. You can go on YouTube and actually find the full footage from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. where it's every single second. And I reviewed a lot of it, although I will say be careful because it does seem like maybe some of the timestamps might be off, especially when we compare them to the recent report from Dr. Lucy Simon. I used a lot of my timestamps from that new report. So keep that all in mind as you're reviewing surveillance footage, as you're looking at the report. This is where I'm getting my reference material. So at 5:24 p.m., Sam calls Ellen, but she doesn't answer. And then he leaves the gym at 5:30 p.m., and you can see him at 5:31 p.m. on surveillance getting onto the lobby elevator while he's reading mail. And I don't want to skate over this. I find this interesting. You're going upstairs. You're going to see your loved one within a matter of seconds. You're getting ready to leave the gym. Why are you calling her? What would be the reason for calling her 6 minutes before going upstairs? Why not just wait until you get up there and then say whatever you have to say? I wonder what he could have been calling her for. If I had the opportunity, I would definitely ask him that question. I would hope that investigators asked him that question because to me, it just doesn't fit. Now, there could be a reasonable explanation for it, but it seems odd to me. Even when I'm at the gym, like physically at a different building, if I know I'm on my way home and I'm going to be there in 15, 20 minutes, unless it's an emergency, I'm not going to call home to say like, hey, what are you up to? What are you doing? I'll see you in a couple of minutes. I'm just going to get my car and go. Maybe that's me. You guys can weigh in down in the comments. That's why we have this discussion. Everyone has different life experiences, but from where I'm sitting, you're in an apartment complex. You're right downstairs. You just saw Ellen a half hour ago and now you're calling her before going upstairs. I don't know. Maybe you guys can let me know what the possibility behind that would be. Now, from 5:32 to 5:54 p.m., Sam repeatedly called and texted Ellen. And as time went on, the messages became more tense. He wrote things like, quote, I'm getting pissed. You better have an excuse. What the fuck? You have no idea. And I've already talked about these text messages and how I interpret them and what I think about them. I don't like them. It could be just him getting frustrated, or there could be more to it. Is this how he normally speaks to Ellen? What does he mean by you have no idea? You better have an excuse. What does this mean? Is this just someone who is a good person who was upset because he couldn't get in the apartment? Or is he someone who had a temper and had the ability to lash out at Ellen? And these text messages are just one example of that. I don't know. It could go either way. But I want to talk about the 5:32 to 5:54 window because I don't see a lot of people discussing this. And I've talked about this a little bit with the team here because to me, this is a window of opportunity. Yes, I know there's text messages and the text messages don't look great. But just stick with me here for a second. What if when he goes upstairs, the door is locked and he's upset and he doesn't wait and then go back downstairs around 6:10 p.m., which we're going to talk about in a minute. What if after like the first text, he breaks the door down? And so he's inside the apartment by 5:40, 5:45. Well, what's going on from 5:45 to 6:10 p.m. when he's seen leaving the lobby elevator and walking towards the concierge desk? This is a question I have, and we don't have the answer because there's no cameras up on that floor where their apartment is, but it's not something that should be looked over. Because if you're in the camp that you believe Sam is involved, that could be the window when something happened. And if he's setting it up to look like something else, in addition to altering the lock and cleaning up the scene, he could be sending these text messages to at least make it appear like he was frustrated because he was still locked outside the apartment. It's just another thing to consider as we're weighing out all the possible scenarios with this case. So as I just mentioned, at 6:10 p.m., Sam was seen leaving the lobby elevator and walking toward the concierge desk. He said he was locked out of his apartment, and when the concierge offered to unlock the door with the master key, Sam said no. It was locked from the inside, and that wasn't going to do the trick. So the concierge instructed Sam to return to the sixth floor and call out to Ellen while they attempted to reach her from the front desk. So Sam went back toward the elevator and presumably back upstairs, and the concierge called Ellen's cell phone, but she did not answer. At 6:14 p.m., Sam made a phone call to his cousin, Kamian Schwartzman. The call was put on speakerphone so that Kamian's father, James Schwartzman, could hear what Sam had to say. I want to note here that Kamian and James are both attorneys. James is also a well-known figure in Philadelphia. He has served as an assistant U.S. attorney, the chairman of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania's Disciplinary Board, and he is currently the chairman of the Ethics and Professional Responsibility Group. So he's very well involved in the politics of Philadelphia. So according to the Schwartzman's attorney, Sam told Kamian and James that he was locked out of the apartment and Ellen wasn't answering. So the Schwartzmans told Sam to go back downstairs and ask security to let him into the apartment. At 6:25 p.m., Sam went back to the concierge desk and he asked to speak with the maintenance team, and that's when they informed him that there was no way to open the latch from the outside, so they suggested he use his shoulder and bust the door in. At 6:31 p.m., Sam was seen walking through the lobby while on the phone with his uncle James, and according to the Schwartzman's attorney, again, Sam said to James that maintenance couldn't help him. Now, these next couple timelines, I'm going to try to get as specific as possible because seconds can be the difference here, right? So at 6:33:06, Sam entered the elevator and headed back up to the sixth floor apartment. At 6:33:59, so less than a minute, Sam calls 911 and reports that he had broken into the apartment and found Ellen. Also worth noting is that Kamian arrived at the apartment building at 6:35 p.m. His father, James, was not with him. At 6:42 p.m., medics responded, and 2 minutes later, the police arrived. And you can see all this on the surveillance footage where you see the medics arriving in the lobby. There's like three or four of them, and then they head up the elevator. So that's the timeline, and I'm not going to dissect it too much. I put it out there so that you could review the facts and come to your own conclusions. For me, personally, I feel like the window in which he gets on the lobby elevator at that 6:33:06 time to him getting into the apartment at the 6:33:59, it's a very small window. It's a very, very small window. And for me, 53 seconds to get up the elevator, get down the hallway, break down the door, go into the apartment, find your fiance, check on her quickly, get your phone, dial 911, to do that all under 53 seconds. That's fast. It's not impossible, but I have a hard time wrapping my head around it. We still have more to cover, including what happened after Ellen was found, not only with the autopsy report, but other people who got involved with this investigation. We're going to get into it right after this last break. So I don't talk a lot about finances on this platform, but I will tell you, I take it very seriously. I'm investing for not only myself, but for my children. And I do have money in stocks and different IRAs and some mutual funds, but I also invest in tangible items like gold and silver. And I actually just made a recent purchase. I'm not going to say exactly for how much or what I purchased because, you know, I got a house to protect. But I can tell you it was a substantial amount because the market is so uncertain right now. And one thing that I know is that gold and silver, there'll always be a need for, especially if, you know, things get really bad out there, to have that tangible product other than just a dollar amount in a bank account that you may not be able to access. I think that's extremely important. And owning gold used to be really complicated, but Acre Gold has made that process simple. First step, all you have to do is pick a subscription plan that fits your budget. Then step two, make small automatic monthly payments, no huge upfront cost. Then step three, which is, in my opinion, the most fun part, once you've built up enough, Acre Gold will ship you Swiss-made certified 24-karat gold bars straight to your door, discreetly and securely. That's it. No guesswork, just steady accumulation of real wealth. Acre Gold has had customers that have been with them for over 5 years because accumulating gold doesn't go out of style. And if you've been following the market at all, then you already know that gold has been on a tear. Its price has risen over 40% just in the last year. So the best time to subscribe is now. Stop working for your money and make your money work for you. Go to getacregold.com to sign up. Again, that's getacregold.com. The countdown is on. Holiday shopping is officially here, and I'm stoked about it. I love buying gifts for everybody. And Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds you won't see anywhere else. So don't wait, because the most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now is the perfect time to cross names off your list. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the US. Many are crafted by independent artists or small businesses, making every gift feel meaningful and truly one of a kind. I buy stuff from Uncommon Goods all the time. In fact, one of the first things I bought was a marble run. So I was looking for something for me and Tenley to do, and this was kind of a puzzle that had a payoff at the end. And we liked it so much that we ended up buying all the other sets from Uncommon Goods as well to kind of piece it all together and make it one big puzzle. And truly, this was something that I hadn't seen anywhere else. I hadn't even thought of it. It was just scrolling through Uncommon Goods, stumbled on it and said, hey, that looks pretty cool. And the quality was incredible. And they really do have something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard football fans to foodies and mixologists and avid gardeners. You'll find new gift ideas for anyone in your family, regardless of their hobbies. And as I alluded to earlier, when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. And many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches. So if you want to get in on it, you have to shop now before they sell out this holiday season. Plus, they give back. With every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated over $3 million to date. So don't wait. Cross the names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/detective. That's uncommongoods.com/detective for 15% off. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. Okay, we're back. And before the break, the last thing I left off with is 6:42 p.m., that's when the medics responded, and then 2 minutes later, police arrived. And some point after that, Sam's parents and his uncle James also arrived at the apartment. Later that night, Ellen's body was transported for autopsy with the knife still embedded in her chest, and for reasons unknown, the knife was never tested for fingerprints, just DNA. And like we talked about in part one, only Ellen's DNA was found. Well, like I talked about in part two, you could say that would lead you to believe it was a suicide, right? She's the only one with her DNA on the knife, therefore it had to be her who stabbed herself. I could argue that the fact that a knife that's in a common area of the apartment that you have to assume has been used by Sam as well at some point, the fact that it has none of his DNA on the knife could suggest that this was a staged scene. And in that scenario, he would have stabbed her in the chest with a knife, wiped it clean, and then took her hand or her arm and rubbed it along the handle to make it look like a suicide. You could go either way with this depending on what you want to believe. If you believe suicide, then you're going to say, yeah, it's her DNA, it's her with the knife. If you're homicide, you can say, yeah, of course you're only going to find her DNA. That's what they wanted you to find. So for me, it's a 50-50. I think it's relevant. I think it's important, but it doesn't sway me one way or the other. According to court documents, in the early morning hours of January 27th, before Ellen's autopsy was completed, James and Kamian contacted the apartment building's property manager, Melissa, and requested access to the apartment. Melissa called the police and asked whether that was allowed. She told them that she was unsure and felt that the family should at least be escorted by officers, but the police said it was fine. No escort needed. Police also recommended a crime scene cleanup service and said it was okay for the family to hire them. Melissa then called James back and told him he could have access to the apartment. She also passed along the police recommendation for the cleanup company. He immediately agreed to cover the cost, and Melissa arranged for the cleaning to be completed before he and Kamian arrived. So a lot of people have really jumped onto this, and I mentioned it in part one, And they talk about how suspicious this looks to have the apartment cleaned before Ellen's autopsy is even conducted. And I get it. The optics do not look great, especially when you consider everything else that we've already talked about tonight. But I'm here for the truth. I'm not here to support one theory or the other. And wherever the breadcrumbs take me, I'm going to go. And if there's alternate routes, I'm going to explore all of them. That's what you're supposed to do. So in this scenario, many of you have already mentioned how suspicious it is that they cleaned the apartment so quickly. But allow me to play devil's advocate, which I love to do. You guys know that. If these guys aren't involved in anything nefarious and they believe that their loved one, Sam, just lost his fiance to a suicide and the apartment is in shambles, right? There's blood everywhere. It's a really bad scene. Would it be out of the ordinary to go in there and have a cleaning service, clean the apartment before Sam goes back into the apartment? Of course. You're not going to want to go in there. Nobody's going to want to go in there until it's clean. And I don't see any family members volunteering to go clean it up themselves. It's just not how it's going to go. It's not practical. So is there a world where, whether it's a suicide or a homicide, that James and Kamian got involved and decided to help because they're just family members trying to help out a loved one? And after calling Melissa, who then called law enforcement, who then gave permission for them to have the crime scene cleaned up, for them to go forward with it, you can't really blame them if they're not involved. Now, as far as law enforcement, that's a whole different issue. I've already talked about it. I don't agree with the fact that they ruled it a suicide so quickly. I don't agree with the fact that they didn't have crime scene technicians go in there and analyze everything in that apartment before anybody touched it. I don't agree with them not seizing any evidence, including laptops and cell phones that could potentially lead to something in the case. I don't agree with any of it. I think law enforcement handled it very poorly. I don't see how you come to the conclusion so quickly that it's a suicide when the only real source of information you have is potentially the only other person who could be involved. So I don't agree with any of it. I don't condone it whatsoever. It was terrible. But the two things, we can't conflate them. What James and Kamian did, it could be completely separate from law enforcement, whether you believe it's corruption or just incompetence. They may not be involved. So I just want to at least entertain that possibility because we're not here with blinders on. That's not what we do on this channel. Now, one thing I do want to mention, which I thought was funny because Melissa did more police work than the police department. She actually took it upon herself to take a video of each room in the apartment to document the condition of the apartment before it was cleaned. And she turned that tape over to police that same day. But when the Greenbergs' attorneys requested a copy of it later, police said it didn't exist. Are any of us shocked by that? Not at all. But after this recording was taken by Melissa, because why would she lie about that? A cleaning crew did come in and they took care of the apartment. They cleaned everything up, which is obviously horrible for the actual investigation. But there we are. We can't go back. Once that was done, James and Kamian were allowed inside and they removed Sam's laptop, Ellen's personal laptop, her work laptop, her purse, and her cell phone. And that, to me, is a little different than the cleanup. I would love to ask them directly why they decided to take her belongings. I'm sure they would say, hey, listen, that's his fiance. They want to give them to Sam. And then if Sam wants to give them to Ellen's family, that's the best way to do that. However, 2 days later, the laptops and Ellen's cell phone were turned over to police. So why wouldn't you just call law enforcement and say, hey, we're taking Sam's stuff. If you want to come get Ellen's stuff, we'll let you take it. Again, I'm sure they would say, oh, we were just trying to help. But optics, the optics here, they're attorneys. They have to know that there's going to be some pushback on this case. And you want to try to avoid any type of conflict or any type of speculation about potential corruption or involvement or covering up of anything down the road. Personally, for me, I'm not taking anything. If Sam wants to come grab something, he can. If Ellen's family wants to come grab her belongings, they can. I'm not going that far. So the fact that they turned those items over 2 days later, I don't love it. And according to court documents, police did not ask why the Schwartzmans had the devices in the first place or whether anything had been done to them before turning them over. Again, another mistake. And those laptops were sent off for testing and nothing of note was found at that time. Although you can't really put too much stock in that because, as I just mentioned, for 2 days, those laptops and cell phones were unaccounted for. And again, if you're in the camp of believing that Sam is possibly involved, what a perfect time to do whatever you have to do to those devices to make sure that nothing of value against you is found that could potentially incriminate you down the road. So as the Greenbergs continued preparing for the civil lawsuit trial, multiple medical examiners were called to provide depositions. Dr. Osborne revealed significant details during his. According to court documents, he explained that members of law enforcement and other city officials pressured him to change Ellen's manner of death. He said he was called into an unprecedented meeting with the chief medical examiner, Dr. Galino, a high-ranking representative from the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, and two police officers. During the meeting, police presented what they believed were signs of suicide, including the lack of defensive wounds and the claim that the door was locked from the inside. They also told Osborne that the security guard witnessed Sam break the door down, and this information actually made it into the autopsy report. It states that, quote, an apartment security man was reportedly present during the entry. However, that turned out to be false. The security guard on duty testified on his own deposition that he did not accompany Sam to the apartment. It's unclear where this misinformation came from, as Sam did not tell police anything about a security guard going with him. Either way, after that unexpected meeting, Dr. Osborne asked neuropathologist Dr. Rourke Adams to evaluate the spinal cord injury. He testified that whenever she had examined an autopsy case for him in the past, she always produced a written report. In Ellen's case, she did not. Dr. Osborne went on to say that she only performed a, quote, curbside examination and did not conduct any histologic or microscopic review. Dr. Osborne went on to say that following Dr. Rourke Adams' determination, he ultimately changed Ellen's manner of death to suicide. And this is interesting to me because I was a police officer for 13 years. Dr. Priya was a pathologist right here at the Rhode Island Medical Examiner's Office. I never worked with her directly, but I've been down to that building dozens of times and sat in on multiple autopsies. I've never had a case when I was a detective where I disagreed with the findings. Fortunately, they all kind of aligned. But I have worked cases privately where I did disagree with the pathologist. And in those instances, I would reach out to them and I would have an outside expert come in. They would give their analysis. And if they didn't agree, I would try to set up a meeting with all three of us to discuss it. There was even one time where I took the ME out for dinner just to have a business meeting and talk about the findings. But I've never had a situation personally or one that I've even heard about where you have the district attorney's office, you have law enforcement officers, you have other high-ranking officials present for this meeting when this is just a quote-unquote suicide. Seems like a lot of people had a lot vested in this case. Now, why that is, your guess is as good as mine. It could be on one end of the spectrum where it's the highest level of corruption from law enforcement all the way up to the district attorney's office, or on the other end of the spectrum, a few people who truly believe that it was a suicide. Now, somewhere in the middle there, which a lot of people don't talk about, is hubris and ego, where you have law enforcement officers who went in there, they think they know it all, they look at the scene, they make an immediate determination, and they hate when anyone questions them. So this is no longer about Ellen or this case. This is about them, their credibility, and their reputation. And they don't like the fact that Dr. Osborne isn't going along with what they've already determined, even though they're not doctors. So a lot at play here, a lot of different scenarios that could be taking place. And from what we do know about this meeting, there are elements of it that would support whatever theory you believe in. So you're not wrong. And your concerns and your frustrations are absolutely valid. Next, I want to talk about Dr. Emery from the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office, who provided a deposition as well, and everything she shared was new information to both the Greenbergs and their attorneys. Dr. Emery testified that in 2019, Dr. Galino asked her to examine Ellen's spinal cord because he doubted that Dr. Osborne had actually consulted with Dr. Rourke Adams. Dr. Emery reviewed the spinal cord and noted the lack of hemorrhage. Her conclusion was that the spinal cord injury occurred after Ellen was already dead. She also testified that she was instructed by Dr. Galino not to write a report about her findings. Instead, she told him verbally that the injury appeared to be post-mortem, and despite that revelation, Ellen's manner of death was not changed. So with this new information, I think it's fair to say Dr. Galino, not good at his job. Is it incompetence? Is it corruption? Is it somewhere in between? We don't truly know. If we did, that's what we'd be talking about right now. But what we do know is that he's not doing things the right way. To have a doctor conduct an examination, but then instruct them not to write a report, suggests some form of malice. Why would you not want that on paper? There's something to that. It's not because you're doing the right thing. The question is why? Is it because, again, you don't want to be wrong? Or are you covering up for someone because this goes much higher than we know? After uncovering all this new information, the Greenbergs filed a lawsuit against the city of Philadelphia, alleging that officials had conspired to cover up Ellen's murder. Their lawsuit against the medical examiner's office also continued, and I completely agree with this. Based on what I just described to you, it's exactly what I said. Either it's someone not doing their job, or they're deliberately taking steps to cover up what happened to your daughter. Absolutely the right move to sue the city. And when you have colleagues going under oath, giving a testimony to support the fact that people were telling them deliberately not to write anything down on paper, that's not good. Something more is going on here. The question is what? In early 2025, as the Greenbergs' trial was approaching, Dr. Osborne submitted a sworn statement revealing that he no longer believed Ellen's manner of death should be classified as a suicide. Right after that happened, the city of Philadelphia settled both lawsuits with an agreement to reevaluate Ellen's manner of death. Months passed before the reevaluation was completed. Then, on October 10th, 2025, Philadelphia Chief Medical Examiner Lindsay Simon issued a 32-page report on Ellen's case. Dr. Simon wrote that while examining the photographs from Dr. Osborne's autopsy, she located 3 superficial stab wounds and 21 contusions that were not documented in the original autopsy. That raised the total to 23 stab wounds and 32 contusions. Despite that new information and a lot of the things that we've talked about throughout the series, she ultimately concluded that Ellen's death was a suicide. And this was a decision that shocked and maddened the public, along with the Greenbergs and their attorney. He called the report rubbish and continued to push for a full investigation. And this is the report that I've referred to throughout this series. It recently dropped and it recharged this case. And then you had the Hulu documentary that came out around the same time. And so that's why it's so polarizing right now. But yeah, this report is troubling. I had mentioned when I was speaking to Dr. Priya that, yeah, there was a lot of medical analysis in there. They cited a lot of other experts who also thought this was a homicide, but at the end, she still comes to a suicide. And my biggest issue with it was, yes, there was an analysis of the autopsy, but there was also a lot of investigative jargon. I felt like it was something that I would write as a detective. And I think it's safe to assume that because of the significance of this case, there were a lot of eyes that were put on this report before it went public. And that would include other people in the medical examiner's office, people at the police department, people in the district attorney's office. And if that's the case, you have to ask the question, how much stock can you put in this assessment? There's a lot of internal pressure there. These are your colleagues. They all believe it's one thing. If you come out and say something different, that's not just going to be for that day. That's going to be for the rest of your career. So to think as a human being that wouldn't put some pressure on you and potentially sway you one way or the other, that would be unreasonable not to think that's a possibility. And that is why this case needed to be investigated by an outside party, whether that was federal authorities or an independent organization that both the district attorney's office and the Greenbergs agreed on. But that wasn't done. And this is what we're left with. And that's why we still have more questions than answers. And unfortunately, there have been no further updates in Ellen's case since that 32-page report was released. Now, while the outcome has not been what the Greenbergs hoped for, one thing remains clear. They're not giving up. They will continue fighting for the truth in Ellen's case for as long as it takes. All right, let's dive into this perspective. I know a lot of you have been waiting for this. And as I said in part one, this case has consumed me for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And I've spent a lot of time researching it, looking at the photos, looking at the reports, talking to experts, getting outside opinions, trying to consume all the information that I could to develop an honest opinion on what I think about this case. And if you notice, most of the time, I just have my notebook, which is on the table right here, but I even have some loose pieces of paper because I was writing down thoughts when I was in the car, when I was in bed, and when I'm in the gym. I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop talking about it to other people and just to myself as I was driving, as I was sitting with my kids. It got bad. And that is why I feel comfortable sitting here and telling all of you that I do not believe Ellen killed herself. I do believe this is a homicide. And it's not only because of what I discussed with Dr. Priya or everything I discussed with you tonight. From a detective perspective, there are things about the crime scene that concern me. And that's what I want to focus on in this perspective, because there are things that are talked about online and in other forums, but I think they need much more attention. So first off, defensive wounds. Some would say that's a sign of suicide. I would say that's a sign of homicide. If her back is turned to her offender, she's not going to defend herself. And if the first stab wound is in the back of her neck and hits her cerebellum, she's not going to have an ability to move her arms, and therefore there would not be defensive wounds. The lack of DNA. Officials in this case say it's a sign that it was a suicide because only Ellen's DNA was found. I would argue that it's a sign that it was a cleanup and that someone deliberately did that so that when law enforcement analyzed the knife handle, they would only find her DNA and would rule it a suicide. Good job, guys. I also think that the digital evidence in Ellen's case is important as well. I mentioned in part one that she was having an ongoing text message conversation with a friend and that abruptly ended at 3:47 p.m. There was no other movement on her phone, but there was some activity at 4:46 p.m. right as Sam was leaving the apartment. And as I also mentioned, his phone went silent around the same time as Ellen's. To me, that information is significant and could represent a point in time when whatever happened to Ellen took place, and the 4:46 activity on her work laptop is actually a diversion to support the notion that this was a suicide. Again, good job, guys. You fell for it. We also have the 911 call. And as I said before, I don't emphasize too much on voice analysis. That's not my field of expertise, but I've seen the crime scene photos and I know many of you have as well. The knife is sticking right out of her chest above her zippered up sweatshirt. There is no way you wouldn't see that immediately. It's visible, especially if she's in that same position that we see her in those crime scene photos. The whole reaction, oh, she stabbed herself. She's got a knife in her chest. It didn't come off as sincere. And I don't know why that would have to be a reaction when the first thing you would see is this huge knife sticking out of your fiance's chest. We have the knife block knocked over with two of the knives in the sink, which could indicate a confrontation. You also have tons of contusions on Ellen's body, along with injury to the strap muscle of her neck, which could indicate strangulation. So there's a lot there already. And there's one other thing that I haven't stopped thinking about since I heard about this case and started diving into it, but I'm going to save it for the end. Before we get to that, we also got to talk about the commonsensical stuff. Yeah, there's no template for suicide. You're not always going to have them commit some type of self-harm beforehand, but you would expect to see something. And no one in her life, including Sam, have ever said that she was suicidal or committing some form of self-harm. She was text messaging a friend. She was making dinner reservations. She was planning for a wedding. And it looks like she was making a fruit salad. That's genuinely what it looks like in that apartment. So not having certain elements of a suicide is understandable, but missing the majority of them is extremely unique, which is what the experts, who are much smarter than me, have already pointed out. All of this leads me to the major question. Who killed Ellen Greenberg? First, I want to start with the more unlikely scenario and suspect, which is that this was a person who lived in the building, a neighbor, someone who was either on that floor or on one of the floors close to them where they had seen Ellen and Sam before and potentially knew their schedule. So if that's the scenario, this person waits for Sam to go downstairs. They approach the door. Maybe Ellen already knows them. She opens. They say, hey, I need something, some sugar or a fork or whatever, paper towels, whatever it might be. Sure, no problem. Come in. I'll grab them for you. When Ellen turns her back, she is attacked. And that's when whatever transpires, transpires. And that's why she's found the way she is. And that's where you see the initial injuries to the top of the head and to the back of the neck. And as she turns around, maybe just naturally, even though she doesn't have any mobility, she's stabbed in the chest. And at that point, and I can't explain it, this neighbor who has practiced on their own door is able to lock the door from the inside before leaving. We've already established from people that work there that it's possible. So if you live in the building, you have plenty of time to practice. At that point, Sam comes upstairs and everything that he said happened happens exactly the way he said it. He eventually breaks the door down, comes inside, and that's when he finds Ellen. Do I believe that's what happened? No, it is not. Can I sit here and tell you with 100% certainty that it didn't happen? No, I cannot. And that's why I'm talking about it. I have no skin in this game. I want the truth for Ellen and her family. So I have an obligation to myself and to all of you to make sure I explore every scenario. And if I can't definitively rule it out, then I have to talk about it. And that's why I'm doing it. But now we have to transition to the scenario and suspect that everybody's talking about, and that's Sam. Sam was the last person to see her alive. Sam has said and done some questionable things that makes you wonder if he's telling the complete truth. And there are a couple potential scenarios where Sam was involved in Ellen's murder. The first scenario would be what I alluded to earlier, which is that at 3:37 p.m., when Ellen stopped responding to her text messages, something at that time or shortly before it happened in the household. It could have been an argument between Sam and Ellen over her being stressed out about grades and him just being sick of hearing about it. She may have said some things to him. He may have said some things to her. There could have been a history of abuse in the house, both verbal and physical, that we just weren't aware of. And potentially it escalated that day. She could have said some things while she had her back turned to him. And it got to a level where before he realized what he had done, it was too late. And at that point, he had to go into crisis mode and he had to create a scene where it looked like Ellen had killed herself and he was removed from the apartment long enough where he could have an alibi. So after cleaning up after himself and cleaning up the scene and making it look the way it did, he goes downstairs. But before doing so, he breaks the lock. He breaks the lock from the inside, shuts the door, heads down to the gym, calls her to make it look like, yeah, you know, I knew she was still up there, you know, no big deal. Goes up a couple times, make sure that the concierge sees him, make sure that he calls maintenance, make sure that a neighbor sees him struggling with the door. Then finally, he goes inside and that's when he finds Ellen and that's when he makes the 911 call. Another scenario that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about, but I mentioned it briefly earlier in this episode. What if there was an argument that happened before he went down to the gym? They got heated at each other. He's upset that she keeps talking about grades. She's saying things to him, got a little bit out of hand. So he goes downstairs to work out. When he does, she's still upset with him. So she locks the door. She's being a little spiteful, you know, playing games. It happens. No big deal. So he comes up from the gym. She didn't pick up his phone call. That already pissed him off. When he gets upstairs, he sends the first text message. She doesn't answer. Again, she could be behind the door just kind of playing dumb. You know, we've all had those arguments. We've all had those fights. We've all pushed each other's buttons. And so he breaks down the door. He's upset. He's frustrated. He shoulders the door, pushes it in. And at that point, it's on. They're arguing. They're fighting. At some point, she goes to the counter. She's cutting up fruit. She's still going back and forth with him, but now she has the knife in her hand. He gets closer. He grabs a knife out of the knife block, and that's when he stabs her. Now, the window here is much smaller. We're talking maybe 20 minutes. And I acknowledge that setting up this scene and removing any potential evidence that could implicate you in this window of time would be very difficult, but not impossible. And then at that point, you go back downstairs. Again, you see the concierge, you call maintenance, you do everything that we know he did until you eventually, quote unquote, break down the door, go inside and find Ellen. And I know a lot of people are coming at Sam, and I understand why. He had means, he had opportunity, and he potentially had motive, although nobody has any clue what that could have been. I don't care who you are. No one has said anything to me that is supported by actual evidence. And that is what makes this case difficult, because you ask yourself, why would he go to this extreme? Why would he do this? And I'm with you. But I could also say, why would Ellen do this? What would her motive be? What was so wrong in her life that she felt she had no other choice? She had never committed any type of self-harm, no suicidal tendencies from anybody she knows. Her life was really just picking up. She had a job. Yes, it was stressful, but she had the career that she wanted, even though this may not be the exact role that she felt like she fit into. She was getting married. She had her apartment. She has a beautiful family. She's got a lot of things going for her. For her, in just a matter of minutes after Sam goes downstairs, to decide, nope, that's it, I'm ending it all, when according to Sam, there were no indications of that before he left the apartment, that's also a tough pill to swallow. But I'll tell you what has bothered me about this case, more specifically Sam, since the moment I read it, and I've kept it to myself until now. It's not the latch. It's not Sam's 911 call and the timeline in which he made that call, how quickly it was after he went upstairs and allegedly broke the door. It's not his reaction to finding this huge knife in his fiance's chest. It's his comfortability. What do I mean by that? Well, let's put yourself in his shoes. You're with your fiance. Everything's fine. You go downstairs to the gym. You have a good workout. You come back up. The door is locked. And according to Sam, the door is never locked. Ellen doesn't lock that door unless she's in the shower or sleeping. And the door is locked for an extended period of time. You're upset. You can't get inside. You don't know what's going on the other side of that door. My first reaction is, did something happen to my fiance? Is she okay? Did she have an accident? Did she get hurt? Did she have a medical issue that she was unaware of? I'm breaking down that door within 5 or 10 minutes. Not even. I want to make sure that she's okay. But let's give him a pass on that. Let's say he's more patient than I am. He goes through all the proper channels. He tries other avenues to see if he can get the door unlocked. When he can't, he finally decides to break down the door. And when he does, he's faced with this horrific scene. His fiance bloodied in the kitchen with this huge knife sticking out of her chest. His first reaction, she stabbed herself. That's a problem. But even more importantly than that, if I'm him and that door was locked the whole time, I'm going to think, oh my God, someone just stabbed her. And my second thought will be, that person must still be inside this apartment. The door was locked from the inside. They didn't want me to come in after her. They thought I would leave. They're still in here somewhere. I need to find them, or I need to get me and my fiance out of this apartment as fast as possible. That's not what he does. At no point does he suggest that Ellen could have been stabbed. No. He says she stabbed herself or she fell on the knife. He never indicated during that 911 call that he too could be in danger. Why is that? Comfortability. So we have to ask ourselves, how could someone feel that safe with those set of circumstances? There's only one way I can think of, is if he knew for certain who actually locked that door. And that's all I have to say about it. I think Ellen Greenberg was murdered. I think her autopsy should have been ruled a homicide. In saying that, I have to qualify from both a professional and legal standpoint that I do not know what happened to Ellen. I can only give my opinion. And I don't know if Sam was involved in any way, shape, or form. I'm discussing the theories that have been out there and how there could potentially be validity to what people have said. Overall, what my big takeaway from this case is, we need an outside entity to take a look at it. Not anybody in the district attorney's office in Philadelphia, not anybody from the medical examiner's office in Philadelphia, not any of the investigators who originally worked on this case. This needs to go up to the federal level. We need to have an independent pathologist who has been recommended by a federal entity or an independent party who has no connection to the Greenbergs or anybody else who's already worked on this case. I don't know what they'll find or what determination they'll come to, but we need that. Not only for Ellen, not only for her family, not only for that community, but the entire country. Everyone is enamored by this case, not only because they can see themselves in Ellen, but because they think about how this case was conducted and wonder, is that the type of officers that are working in my community? I talk about it all the time. When you have poor police work, it affects not only that agency, but every law enforcement officer out there. And the negative publicity goes a lot further than the positive. So we have to police the police. We have to call it out when we see it, and we have to correct it as soon as possible. We don't need another review of the autopsy report. We need a full investigation, and I really hope that happens. And if it does, I'll be right here letting all of you know. Now, this is the point where I'll usually close out the show, but I do have a couple things I want to run by you guys. First off, I appreciate you guys staying with me on this multi-part series. It was a lot. It took a lot out of me. I hope I did this case justice. And if this is something you would like to see me do again, please let me know. I'm not going to do it right away. Like I said, this was consuming, but we will absolutely do it on another case if you guys want to see me do something like this again. And we will definitely have more interviews with experts in the future. And now for a little bit of personal stuff. I'm actually recording this on October 30th into the 31st. So happy Halloween for anybody who's watching or listening to this right now. It's already passed for you guys, but it just occurred for me. Reason I'm doing this is because I'm going on vacation. And I do have the next case researched and written, but I want to wait till I get back. So it will be out later in the week. Don't expect it on Monday or Tuesday, but I promise there is an episode coming out. Hopefully when I come back, I have a little bit of a tan, although I'm not holding my breath. But as always, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.